belonging to England captain Harry Kane and midfielder Jude Bellingham were among the stolen items.
The U.S. opened its first home World Cup in 32 years with a 4-1 victory over Paraguay. The game took place in front of a sold-out crowd. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
Hey, welcome to The Conversation on WVIK. It's a weekly celebration of local radio the way it's meant to be brewed. This week, my guest is Holly Sparkman from the Quad Cities Area Film Office. I'm Kai Swanson. I hope you'll stick around for this week's conversation. Well, you know, I really love these programs when it features someone that I've known for a long time and in several expressions and chapters in their lives, and then they go and do something really cool, as though you haven't done everything cool your whole life, Holly, and then I get a chance to sit down with you and find out more because I am, as the Swedes say, new, feek, and nosy. Holly Sparkman, welcome to The Conversation. Happy to have you here.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, let's start. Let's go back a little bit here. I have memories of how you and I started working together. It was mostly after you were a student, and I think through the public relations network in the Quad Cities, as it was.
Yeah.
But let's go back even before that. Where did you grow up?
Geneseo, Illinois. I was born in Peoria. My father worked for Caterpillar. Mom was a nurse at Methodist Hospital at the time in Peoria. That's where she got her degree. And we moved. Dad got transferred for the Mount Joy plant. They were opening the Mount Joy plant in Davenport, and he was a part of that team. So we moved to Geneseo in 1976, maybe.
Mm-hmm. And then you were a Maple Leaf.
I was.
All right.
Or the Green Machine.
Or the Green Machine in those years. It absolutely was.
A little more fierce.
It absolutely was.
The Leafs.
What were some of the things that caught your attention and your imagination when you were in high school? Because I know sometimes we do things in high school that, you know, they pave the way for what we do later.
Mm-hmm. It was the 80s, you know. And yeah, we were all about music and big hair and wild clothes and you know, all that. Yeah, yeah. I was in band. And
what was your instrument?
Clarinet.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, clarinet. In high school was the end of that, you know. Didn't ride that out for very long. But my interests lie in like history, archaeology, the past. For whatever reason, my dad loved National Geographic magazine. That's what he would read to me sometimes. I'd get the storybooks, but then I liked the pictures in National Geographic. And so I'm like, what's that about? And so he'd you know, read parts to me. And I'm still a fan of the magazine. And I think that's where I got my penchant for old things, you know, Egyptology, Mesoamerican, early, you know, Mayan. That.
I have a bit of a story about National Geographic magazine, and it has to do with in the mid-70s, and my folks were they made sure that we had a subscription the whole time I was growing up, you know, and I would sit there and just go through the pages and pages and pages and pages. And I remember it was, I think, in the mid-70s, their cover story was the Terracotta Warriors from Xi'an in China. And I devoured that, just devoured it, and read every little thing, opened the pull-out maps and all this kind of stuff, because they'd only unearthed like a sliver of it. And then in 2009, I got to lead an alumni trip there. And it was overwhelming emotionally to stand there, because I remember when that came out, I was in junior high, and I thought, well, this is very interesting, but I love National Geographic. I'll see it here. I will never see this in person. Other side of the world, China was communist, never going to happen, right? And then to stand there and to see those with that entree of the magazine in my youth, it was very overwhelming. Mm-hmm. So yeah. Anyway, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's. And for me, it was just about, you know, how, you know, and then I got interested in anthropology, and there was one issue where it was going through, and I think it was a time when, have you ever heard the name Louis Leakey?
Mm-hmm,
You know, they were digging, and they found Lucy.
Right.
Australopithecus efferensis, you know, the evolution of, and so there's this whole National Geographic spread of the evolution of humans and going through that, you know, Gigantopithecus. And then there was these offshoots, the Denisovians and, you know, Neanderthals and, you know, and I just thought, man, that's fascinating, you know, and that's what I wanted to study, you know, and that's more physical anthropology than cultural anthropology. But so, yeah, when I, my freshman year of college, and I went to North Central.
Yeah,
because they had a great anthropology program, Dr. McVicker. I really connected with him and loved his classes. And so, yeah, and then got really interested in Mayan archaeology and went to the University of Texas a couple years in a row to study the glyphs, the Mayan hieroglyphs and translations and history behind that, and met this really wonderful woman, Linda Shealy, who, she was an art historian, but got bit by the Mayan bug and just dove into it and wrote several really good books on the subject.
Was that in Austin where you went to do that?
Yep.
I was going to put in a plug. By hooks and crooks, I was in Austin earlier this year, had a couple of hours to spare, and we went to the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center, which may not have been there when we were in our student days, but it's just a beautiful facility. She was passionate about wildflowers, and if you get a chance in Austin, I know everyone else goes to South by Southwest, but steer off the beaten
path. I might
have
to go there for the film office someday. So,
hey,
look
it up. It's really, really cool.
Yeah, so, I haven't been back there since, but yeah.
Well, and then how did that road wind up leading you to River City? How did that happen?
Well, yeah, long story really short. Yeah. I came back home. My father was ill. So, yeah, it was a natural segue to transfer to Augustana. And there was no anthropology program here at the time, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But fortunately, Dr. Mary Kern took me under her wing and said, you know what, I think we can make some connections here for you in art history. And that was the case. And so, yeah, I dove right in and loved it and got my degree in art history.
Yeah. Well, that's a cool story. And, you know, the thing about we get these twists and turns in our life. And it really brings home the line from Frost, knowing how way leads unto way, right? Sometimes we do something that may seem at the time to be an impediment or somehow a hindrance, but it turns out to open up other things. Mm-hmm. So I'm grateful your path took you to Mary M. Kern.
And Mr. Dr. Kern, as I used to call him, too. He was wonderful.
Delightful couple. I think she's in the Midwest now. She had been in Florida for a while, but I just recently, we'll be gossipy a little bit later. But anyway, I'm glad that happened.
Yeah.
And then from Augustana, were you looking to follow on art history, or what were those next steps after school?
I had applied to University of Iowa to get my master's in fine arts, but that really didn't work out. I had a son,
Yeah.
Yeah. When I was a junior. And so I just, you know, just really needed to focus on finding a job and working.
Sure. Yeah. And again, I saw you in the public relations communications phase. Tell me about the journey.
Yeah. I learned really pretty much all I needed to learn at PR Network. I mean, what a great organization. And we just brought it back together last year and started doing the lunch and learns again and building the membership back up again. It kind of, as things happened in COVID, it kind of fell apart. And so we got it back together and we hit the ground running and we're planning for next year. But yeah, and it was kind of a natural thing to me. And I don't know, it's because of the liberal arts aspect of Augustana College and making yourself malleable enough to really flow into another career field, you know, being capable of adjusting and pivoting like that. But I loved it. I loved marketing. I loved communications and I loved PR. And I just kept growing it from there.
Well, the reason I was able to make the transition from WVIK newsroom to a public relations, and that was in 95, is that while I was working at WVIK in the newsroom, I have always been kind of voluntarily inclined, and I started helping out with different things. And I think the most important was probably the Holocaust Remembrance, Yom HaShoah, in the early 90s. And they really had no public relations presence. There's just a few people would show up, and that's great, and it's wonderful. And I thought, you know, I'm getting 800 news releases a day. I should know how to write one. So just in a volunteer capacity, I started doing some PR for them. And then I had gotten involved in Big Brothers Big Sisters and had a great match with a little brother named Frank, who's now not little anymore.
Mm-hmm. Probably in his 30s or something.
He's probably a grandpa by now. I don't know. I hate to say. Let's see. I should do that math. No, it's more than 30s, my dear.
Okay.
My dear friend. Anyway, and they were getting the chapter started. So I was writing some things for them and getting putting together a little newsletter that was used and doing some fundraising. And then lo and behold, there's this knock on the door from the college saying, hey, we need some help with PR. I think I can. It was, you know, the little engine. But thanks, you know, like you said, to
and
that grounding and say, you know, you don't have to know much more than how to learn. So
be
that
willing
helped
to learn and use those critical thinking skills and
what were some of the groups that you've lent your talents to?
The YWCA.
Right.
I mean, I was a longtime board member there, but
Also talking about your PR talents. So you started doing PR for them too, or?
After I retired from the school district, I kind of helped out, you know, because they were in the middle of a capital campaign and building a new building.
But well, we haven't gotten to the school district. I'm talking about the early career in public relations.
Yeah. Well, I worked for the downtown Rock Island Arts and Entertainment District.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. And that was pure marketing. And a lot of public relations too, because I kept, you know, putting information about, you know, what the businesses were doing, how the downtown was reviving, and we were creating that arts and entertainment culture. That was a great job. I loved that job a lot.
Absolutely.
Those were
heady days.
Oh my gosh. It's a blur, but it was great. I mean, we had the best time. I worked with a lot of great people and some of them are still down there. Mm-hmm. You know, John from Huckleberry's, he was our treasurer on the board and, you know, he's still very invested in the downtown. And things have changed a lot, but I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
And that we're growing in the right direction.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And then after that, I segued into bank marketing and communications with the Rock Island Bank.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I segued into higher education and worked at St. Ambrose in the communications and marketing department for a few years there. And then I left St. Ambrose and freelanced for a little while and then eventually ended up at Nelson Communications at the ad agency and did marketing and communications and public relations there, and then Rock Island School District.
And that was it was great to have you at the district because, I mean, one of the reasons I think you thrived so well in all of those spaces is you are a great storyteller. And at the district, you were doing a lot of things to make connections through story. And I really appreciated that.
Yeah.
So I think you got me roped into a couple of things.
Yeah, I did.
There, so.
Yeah. Well, you're a grad.
Yeah, that's right.
You're a Longfellow Lion.
Kind of proud. Oh, yeah. You even remember the Lions.
Yeah.
The Longfellow Lions.
Well, yeah, you carry that badge of honor, you know, wherever you go.
So I was just, all right, it's a sickness, I know, but I collect lapel pins. And years ago, there was a fundraiser for Longfellow. And the premium was a cheesy little cartoonish lion with pride underneath it. And I found that lapel pin as I was trying to make sense of this old collection of it. So, yeah, I'm still a Longfellow Lion, Washington Warrior, Rock Island Rock, and then that other joint too as well. And anyway, it's been a good run. So you were there at the district doing a lot of things. Actually, let's take a little side trip here. One of the things that is, I think, not at all a secret in the community is that in Rock Island has this perception challenge that is not rooted in reality. And I say that because I meet people who are mired in the perception problem, and then I give them a personal guided entree into the community that is Rock Island, and they become fans. So I think it's, you know, that's that sort of contempt prior to investigation phenomenon. But being that storyteller for the district, what were some of the ways you found maybe first the challenges, but then your means of overcoming those challenges?
Yeah, that's interesting that you bring that up. When Jennifer Walker was at with the city of Rock Island, you know, in the community marketing position, she kept track of, she had a big spreadsheet of headlines in the newspaper, you know, about Rock Island, and then placement, and then headlines in the newspaper about other areas and the tone, you know, and for whatever reason, you know, that the Rock Island headlines toned were very, you know, critical, and like the stories that made the front paper were about bad things that are happening in Rock Island. It was hard to get good things happening in Rock Island to the top of that fold. And so, yeah, that was, and she shared that with me, and that's, and I think when I was at looking at applying for the position, and I was like, oh, that's very powerful.
Yeah.
And so we got to really work on finding those stories. And it's just, for me, it's always been about grassroots. You got to talk to people. You know, we held listening sessions at all of the schools. We tried to target and come up with some good campaigns that would tell the good stories about Rock Island. We had a really wonderful education reporters here at the time,
both sides
of the river.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we also had, thankfully, gosh, what was her name? We had our own newspaper, the Rock Island News, Melissa. Then the last name will come to me.
Yeah, we'll get to it. I think, no, I can picture her now.
Cortell? The last name began with a Q.
Cortell.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
You nailed it.
The editor, and I was like, I will help you with all the content you need to get this going. And that was a great, 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 great run. I mean, we were able to tell all the good stories. Did it change the meter?
I don't know. I know the phenomenon.
It's just always an uphill battle.
Yeah.
And you got to live here and appreciate it. To really feel it, and then
maybe it's just mellowing with age, but the people who don't want to know, I don't really need to sell them anymore. We've got enough people here now, and we don't have any traffic jams, and that's fine by me. I will tell you though, my microcosm of the phenomenon that Jennifer was documenting is, while I was the PR director, there was a criminal physical assault without the use of weapons, and it was a certain distance from our campus, okay? It appeared above the fold, and the headline mistakenly said it was gang-related. But it was clearly the association with proximity to this institution of higher learning. Not terribly long after, a similar assault, in fact, in some ways worse because a weapon was involved and serious injuries accrued, happened the same distance from another institution of higher learning in the Quad Cities. And it was a page 5 little thing in the below the fold corner that talked about a crime. And the university was never mentioned. It was just the street, cross street, but same distance from this one. And so I don't know what it is. Fear sells. Right? and it's easier to fan fear than to create it. So if you can build on those perceptions, I guess they see it that as a monetization issue.
Yeah. Well, I could count in my hand. I don't know how, I'd probably need 4 or 5 hands. But every time, you know, one of our schools went into lockdown and, you know, it was front page, and then other schools would go in the lockdown, you know, on the other side of the river or the side of the river. And it would just be like a non-issue or a non-story. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, how does that work?
Well, enough about that. You are doing some amazing things, and we're going to get this more deeply after the break. But first, tell me a little bit about how you came to be associated with the film office.
It's just one of those organic things that kind of happened to me throughout my life, mm-hmm. you know, starting in marketing communications and then banking communications. And, you know, I had taken an interest because I had heard that they wanted to make have a film office here in Rock Island. And this was before COVID, I think. And there were some meetings, and the state film director, deputy director Peter Holly was in town to talk about it. And I was like, oh, that sounds exciting. I'd like to learn more. And maybe that's something that I'd like to do after I retire from the school district. You know, and I just wanted to learn more about it and how I could, you know, figure out how to do something more along the writing lines, you know, script writing, stories. You know, we have so many in the Quad Cities, but also Rock Island, we have so many great potential for some good documentary stories, you know, whether it's about, I want to see one about Suzanne Denkman-Hauberg.
Yep.
I mean, she was an incredible lady, very, you know, who set a lot of foundations here in Rock Island that are still alive today. You know, I just thought we have great potential. We should have film productions here because it's beautiful here. We have great architecture. We have industrial, you know, we've got everything that anybody needs.
Exactly.
And so we should have movie productions here. And so I just heard about it and went to a couple meetings, and here I am.
Well, we're going to talk more about that. But while you're thinking of interesting stories needing to be told, I'd love to learn more about Emma Gale. She was the first librarian. There was a private library, as was often the case in the mid-1800s. But it became Illinois' oldest chartered public library, the Rock Island Public Library. Mm-hmm. So when they got the charter, they just hired Miss Emma Gale, who had been keeping the books, literally, before. And when she started, they didn't even really have a building. They used rooms and offices and that kind of thing. But eventually she was there, I think, in 1903, when the building we now know, the Weyerhaeuser-funded building in downtown Rock Island, was built.
Yep.
But I'd love to know more about Emma Gale, G-A-L-E.
Okay.
So just so you know, friends, Holly's taking notes as I'm, because my guest is Holly Sparkman with the Quad Cities Film Office. Well, I also want to get into the mission of the organization, but I find it fascinating. It kind of fits in with the other thing, and having an art historian doing this kind of work is important because you have an eye that maybe catches detail that others don't. Is there any possibility we might get something on Denkman? You mentioned that one. Is that, or are you just working on it?
Okay, so here's my idea. We have a lot of, and Emma falls right in that category. We have a lot of really fierce women who have, you know, historically been here in Rock Island. Irma Renee Cohen, my good friend, Dr. Cynthia Empin, she did a dissertation on her. She was a painter. She made her living as a painter back in the early, you know, early 1900s, where it was unheard of for women to make a living as an artist, much less.
And we're going to find out even more in just a minute.
Yep.
You'll hold that thought. My guest is Holly Sparkman. You're listening to The Conversation on WVIK.
Quad Cities NPR, WVIK, comes from Lago Marcinos in downtown Moline and the village of East Davenport. Now serving sandwiches on homemade bread and sundaes with homemade ice cream. Lago Marcinos is open Monday through Saturday, 10:30 to 5. More information is at lagomarcinos.com. And support for WVIK Quad Cities NPR also comes from Kathleen Collins Counseling in Bettendorf, offering alternative counseling approaches designed to assist in breaking old patterns, moving forward, and creating meaningful change. Learn more at kathleencollinscounseling.com. And support for WVIK also comes from Impact Life, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Learn about the blood center's name
and the need for blood products and services at bloodcenter.org.
I'm Andy Roman from Rock Island, and WVIK is my NPR station.
Thank you, Andy, and thanks to everyone who's listening this morning. Welcome back to The Conversation on WVIK, a chat with this week's guest, Holly Sparkman from the Quad Cities Film Office. I'm so glad to have you here. So we were just, I interrupted you on a really cool story that you got some info from Cynthia Empen. Please continue, because it sounds like an amazing artist.
Yeah, and there was Cynthia helped coordinate an exhibition over at the Figge a few years ago of Irma Renee Cohen's works.
Oh, now I remember. Yeah, I thought that name sounded familiar.
Catalog, yeah. And but that is a great story.
Hey, there's a great show going on. I got to put in a plug. The Figge's doing a great show right now on the Gilded Age and not being gilded for everyone.
Yep.
So get over and see that. But let's continue with the film office.
Yeah. So I know that. And in the beauty of this area, too, is that I've learned over the last year in doing this job is we have a lot of filmmakers here.
Mm-hmm. We do.
Yeah. They find work outside of this region, which I find very interesting that they're able to make a living doing that. But they choose to live here.
Mm-hmm.
And so. But my job, for the film office is to set up a film commission, which is a special screen sector organization dedicated to economic development for the area,
right?
To bring in production,
because this is huge economic development. Mm-hmm. I think the state of Georgia was early on learning that this is a way to really draw dollars into your state, and they had a great run, but they've kind of been eclipsed. Mm-hmm. And filmmakers are going to Chicago a lot more and other places. And if Chicago reaches capacity, why not just come down I-80 and shoot here?
Yep. And the nice thing is, last fall, we got a nice bump in the film tax credits through our legislation. Thank you to all of our legislators. We get an extra 5% bump outside of Chicago. So a film production can take 40% advantage of those tax credits if they come here and film.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole, it's a complicated whole list of a spreadsheet. And I always leave that to the accountants. You can go talk to the accountant about how that all works.
Yeah.
I can tell you. And there's also a sustainable green incentive where they can get another 5%. So they could hypothetically get 45%. Back in film tax credits.
Right.
If they bring a production here over $100,000.
Right.
And a lot of the filmmakers and the questions that I've gotten from filmmakers who are looking to do something here and asking about locations is their budgets are, over $150,000. So we got plenty of room. Would I love to have $1 million budget film? Sure. And it'll happen. I mean, we have the right pieces in place and... with the Fresh Films Rockline Studio potential in downtown Rock Island, once that gets going, we'll have all of that. And I know that we'll get productions in town and we'll create a good work schedule, sustainable work schedules where we can employ people from this area and really get some good film stuff.
Well, and there's precedent for this, right? A few decades ago, thanks to, I think, someone you're working with, Doug Miller, we attracted the attention of the Avadi brothers, right? And so they did a film about Bix.
Yep.
And then I think they came back they just liked filming here.
And Doug was a part of, there was a film office before this film office.
Right.
They started it in the late 80s and with the intent of recruiting film productions to go here, and the Avadi brothers came in and did several films, and then there was more. Some of them, the one with Brooke Shields and American Love, that was done in 1994. We had one, Mega Fault, that's kind of been a cult classic.
Has it really?
Brittany Murphy and Eric LaSalle. I understand. Sugar, that
right?
Was
about
a great
baseball. Can't go wrong with a baseball movie, especially when you got one of the most beautiful ballparks in the country.
Yeah, and the movie poster, I have a big one in my office. It has a Centennial Bridge in the back.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Very picturesque.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So we've already had a lot of films made here. We can do it.
Yeah. Well, and then we keep, there've been a lot of near misses, right? Mm-hmm. And even in, I haven't seen the whole movie, I confess, but My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2, I don't know if you knew this, this is a little bit of film trivia.
Okay.
But I guess the one of the younger members of the family is going to a college fair. And of course, it's all set in Chicago. And they actually went to an actual college fair. There's a long shot where Augustana's table is in the background.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So you see the two principals up front.
Yeah.
But it was a great ad for Augustana.
Yeah, I'll have to find that clip and get a still of it. I mean, I'm all about using anything I can get to showcase. Yeah.
Can't talk about film in the Quad Cities, I can't, without talking about Chuck A-Strike. And for years, when he was teaching, when he was teaching at Rocky, he taught a class in film. Now, this is those halcyon days when, you know, property taxes were through the roof and Rock Island High School was, it still is a great college preparatory school, but the resources it had were just phenomenal. And he taught a film class. And that class and series of classes produced at least two Student Academy Award winners who went on to SIU and made a film, and then a third who's made his career writing for Disney, Bill Motz. The first two guys, Rob Humphrey, Jim Peterson, they were part of an Academy Award winning film in their college days. But it was all thanks to, I think, Mr. A-Strike and the great work that he did capturing the magic of filmmaking.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. And I, you know, for me, I find that to be a very interesting story. You know, I'm a sucker for good stories, which is why, Holly, every week at this time, I step aside so I can hear from a master storyteller. It's time now on The Conversation for Rock Island Lines with Roald Tweet.
This is Roald Tweet on Rock Island. One of the great teachers of writing in the Rock Island area is no more. Now, would-be writers must sit in other classrooms on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday and do their assignments. There used to be a more natural way of becoming a writer when the Rock Island Lines Railroad was still carrying passengers across the Midwest prairies. It was a method based not on tuition, but intuition. Its classroom was the passenger car. What was it about trains that made every passenger a storyteller? The conductor cried, "All aboard!" Friends left standing on the platform facing us moved past our window like a row of sunflowers disappearing. And even before we realized we were the ones moving, passengers began to imagine each other in stories. Who was that silent antique couple sitting in the far corner opposite each other? Notice how from time to time he would make the slightest gesture with the index finger of one hand, and she, her name was very likely Alberta, knowing what he wanted, would pull out a soda, a thick sandwich, a magazine for him. That gesture was the story of their lives. Closer by was a young couple just out of their teens. She cried every so often. He looked out the window and pretended he did not hear. They were on their way to tell her parents that she was pregnant. The parents would forgive her, and the grandchild would become their joy. The car was full of stories. Were the two prim women with their hair in buns, schoolteachers, of course, going on vacation? Would that man whose wife complained and complained really get off the train in Omaha and never come back? Stories of pilgrims, saints, escapees. Other passengers were busy making stories, too. Stories about me, that funny little kid whose ears stuck out. An invasion of privacy? Hardly. It was by stories like these that the passenger car became a community by trip's end. What more terrifying fate than to be part of no story? How else do we live in this world except as characters in stories others tell?
Rock Island Lines with Roald Tweet is underwritten by Augustana College, Rock Island, Illinois.
And we get to hear it each and every week because folks just like you become members of this public radio station. You know, I was noticing in the news today that there's another deal between billionaires to buy up things that own CNN and other news sources. Well, there's a news source you can tune into each and every day, NPR, thanks to WVIK. And if having that kind of source available to you is important, then it's imperative to us that maybe you pop over to WVIK.org, look at that bright red donate button, and throw in a couple of shekels for the cause. We'd sure appreciate it. My guest this week is Holly Sparkman, who is with the Quad Cities Film Office. And as long as, Holly, I'm throwing out these gratuitous, pitches for folks, tonight's a very special night in our community in that the Rock Island County NAACP's Freedom Fund Banquet is being held, and it features the national leadership of the NAACP coming right here to speak. Now, I don't know if there are tickets available at the door, but it's a sign that that's another great organization to support is the NAACP here in our Quad Cities, whether it's the Metrocom branch across the river, Rock Island County this side, and that's a great way to build our community. But we're talking about another great way, and that's the Quad Cities Film Office. And as long as we're talking about engagement, Holly, how do people get involved in this, or at least keep tabs with the work of the film office? Because I think there are a lot of fans out there that really want to see this thrive.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Our website, QCAfilmOffice.com. We have a newsletter, a monthly newsletter that I put out, you know, what we've been doing, you know, if there's any needs out there. Last week, Fresh Films is bringing in a summer production again this year, and they were in need of a costumer. So I'm building our services directory and location database. I just subscribed onto a new software package, and it's great. Other film offices use it, and I'm getting information in there because my old spreadsheet style of way of doing things was not working for me at all. Yeah.
I've had Eslin Fagley. I've had the Rundles on, you know, mm-hmm. So it's imperative that I get you here too.
We have a newsletter, and I'm trying to support like local film events and filmmakers. We backed with Fourth Wall and Truth First Film Alliance. We did a series back in, I think, May, supported that at the Last Picture House. Mm-hmm. And we're just trying to support filmmakers. I've been having quarterly meetings with our QC filmmaker community just to keep tabs on what they're hearing and what they're working on, because I really feel like they are ones that would be our best salesperson ever. You know, if they hear about productions that are getting into the mode of looking for locations, mm-hmm. you know, send them to me and I can help.
And don't I recall, if I recall correctly, Last Picture House has been a venue for student films, especially during alternating currents, mm-hmm. which I think is coming up pretty soon
in
now,
August.
Right?
In August? Yep, the second week of August.
So you can go see local student productions.
Yes.
What's the state of, do you get to work with encouraging the students who are working on films now around our community?
I actually have two interns this summer from the Augustana College Film Program, Sawyer and Ludovica. And they're helping me put this database together because I need pictures. I need, you know, people to give me their information to put into this database. And they know what they're doing. I mean, they're hitting the ground running.
Well, that's another person I got to get on the show is Dr. Stacy Barton.
Yes, so. Yes. And, I worked with her, last year at Alternating Currents. We showcased the Student Film Awards, mm-hmm. At a special screening. And I'm looking to do the same thing this year, again, having our own special event as a part of Alternating Currents on that Sunday, August 16th. Also looking at bringing in a regional filmmaker. I had helped him get a screening at the Last Picture House last year, William Rock. He did a film called Jury of Her Peers, and it was based on a play by Susan Glassbell, another fierce Quad City woman.
That's
that
right. You got her. I'll remind you to write down Susan.
She's on another list somewhere.
That's right.
He did a wonderful job on that film about the murders in Iowa. Mm-hmm. There was a book written about that too, Midnight Assassin. Mm. And it was, you know, a woman was in bed with her husband, and he got an axe to the head, and, you know, she's the obvious culprit, but did she really do it? No. But the jury at the time, because it was, I forget the year, but there were no women on the jury because they couldn't women on juries. And so jury of her peers was like kind of in as being facetious in a way because she couldn't have her peers on the jury. So I'm looking at hopefully having him screen his movie for alternating currents again.
How does the film office, I get to help out over at Visit Quad Cities, and the staff over there are amazing and sort of waving the flag to visitors, because that's such an important part of economic development. Do you work with sort of these ways of lifting our heads above the crowd to national audiences and filmmakers in other communities?
Yeah, well, we are members of the AFCI, the Association of Film Commissioners International. It's a big consortium of all film offices from around the globe. Mm-hmm. And I was able to go to a studio summit in March in L.A., first time in L.A., a lot to take in anyway. And I was staying on like blocks away from Hollywood Boulevard and Vine and Sunset on the other side. And it was amazing. It was so nice to talk to other people in the same, you know, from film offices, because I can talk to them about my challenges. And if they have any challenges, I don't know what I could do to help, I would listen. And then on the other side, we had exposure to studio executives and a lot of independent film companies. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really where, you know, we are going to focus on all of those independent film companies and bringing them here, because they have the budgets that I like. You know, they're not millions of dollars. I don't know if I could handle that, having a $50 million movie come to town. But yeah, a million, sure. Yeah, I think that's more doable. And some of those independent film companies, I mean, they work with, I'm always amazed. I mean, $250,000 budgets and what they can do with that. They're very, I'm always amazed at what they get done with that and what they scrutinize and what they look at.
Well, also this idea that you're creating a database of professionals who, if you need a film editor or something like that, you could bring them in and at least connect them somehow.
Yeah, and I was floored by all of the resources we do have here. And I found a few gaps, you know, as far as looking at the breadth of everything. And we had we have kind of an equipment gap that we need to fill. Yeah, we could access a lot of companies out of Chicago would be happy to truck a lot of equipment here. And that's great, too. And that's an option. But, you know, we also have resources around here that we could use. Which is the point of having a film office here is, you know, how much of those resources can we use here in the Quad Cities?
You mentioned the fella from the state film office. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that they come close to reaching capacity in Chicago. Is that person, how are you plugged in with them? What's the relationship there?
Peter, yeah, he's wonderful. Every time I've reached out to him, he's always very responsive. And that was his goal because there was a big soundstage grant a few years ago, which is why, you know, how Fresh Films, they just jumped in and said, we're going to do this grant and we're going to bring a studio here. In Champaign-Urbana, there was an old airplane hangar that they turned into a studio called Flyover Studios. And in my mind, this area is a couple years behind them. They're doing great. I think they generated... and don't quote me on this, but, you know, like an additional $4 million in economic impact last year. So I know once we get the Rockline Studios off of the ground, you know, we'll see some of that too. There's another studio, Soundstage in Southern Illinois, that's doing really well. So, yeah, Peter's all about spreading it out around the whole state of Illinois. And I think that's the governor's agenda as well.
Now, we were talking about Doug earlier, and Iowa had a very robust film presence. How has that evolved, and is there opportunities to do cooperation there?
Yeah, that seems to have, you know, that's, I don't know what to say about that, other than there were some issues with that film office, and it kind of fell apart. I think they're... Right now, Produce Iowa, and I talked to the woman quite a bit, EJ Philby, about film office related stuff. But I think that, no, they're working on maybe some film incentive packages, you know, hopefully down the road. They have a very small one that's limited in a certain area of the state, but it might be generating some films there. I don't know. I talked to a couple of filmmakers who applied to do some projects there, but yeah, we'll see what happens with that. But Peter, he's, you know, he knows we're the Quad Cities. And there's an Iowa side to that.
Yeah.
And he's open to, because we're going to include Iowa locations too, across the river. And yeah, a lot of the spend, if they want to take advantage of the Illinois tax credits, has to be in Illinois. But, you know, if they need to go over and film something, the Black Hawk Hotel, yeah, go over for the day, do that, and come back here, you know, and stay in our hotels and that sort of thing.
Well, that's another database that just dawned on me that you've got to keep our locations, right?
Oh, yeah,
and do you capture those somehow visually that, that you can ship off a quick reel or something like that to show them? How do you do that?
Yep. The software package that I have the license to will help me do like a special lookbook. You know, I can take pictures from certain locations depending on what a filmmaker is looking for, and I can hit a couple buttons and poof, here comes this nice little link that I can send people, you know. But last year, you know, my infinite spreadsheet, and then I get a call and we're looking for these pictures. Okay. Then I take pictures and I'd make a flyer and, you know, and I was just like, so not, you know, so time consuming. So I'm excited about getting this database off the ground because it will be very seamless and I will be able to respond quickly. With anybody that has, you know, certain things that they're looking for.
Where is the film office physically located?
Downtown Rock Island on 3rd Avenue, right to the west of Circuit 21.
Oh,
it's the old main camera.
The old main camera?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah, which Doug did, you know, being Doug, he researches everything. And I guess it must have been the Orowitz Deli.
Oh, no.
At that time?
It was next door to Orowitz's Deli.
Okay.
And I, you know, I always feel great guilt.
So is that the Gap? So there's a gap between the Speakeasy.
Right. Yes.
And, there must
have
been a
well, now
gap.
I'd have to look at it. But I think Main and Orowitz's Deli were two different doorways to get into. But
okay.
I, you know, with a healthy dose of Swedish Lutheran guilt, I blame myself for Orowitz's being gone because those who remember Orowitz's, they had heavenly pickles. I mean, they came, I'm sure, straight. They dropped like manna, I'm sure. That's how it had to happen because they were perfect pickles. And they put them out in mason jars. And, you know, being a broke young reporter in like 1986, I'd go down there and I'd get a nice pastrami. And then it, during while I'm waiting for it, I would eat the whole mason jar full of these delightful pickles. Mm. So I blame myself that Orowitz's is no longer
okay.
there, but it's of blessed memory. Yeah. It is of blessed memory indeed.
Yeah.
And Doug would know that, about that.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, he knows.
But I have great memories from Main Camera too, because
Me
when,
too.
When I was in PR, we would do a lot of, we'd have to do a lot of film work and with literal film and then bring it down to Main Camera.
Yeah. I mean, in the '90s, I had a really nice fancy camera and I'd just take all my stuff down there and Roy would crank it out and I'd go back and pick it up and it was nice.
There's
a
great story from Norse mythology that, you know, they talk about this Valhalla, but what it really was is that those who were admitted, right, they would get up in the morning and they would have a terrible, terrible battle and they'd fight and because that's what they enjoyed doing. And then dead or alive or indifferent, at the end of the battle, they would meet and have this massive feast, right? And it was some magical that then Thor slew and then it regenerated. Yeah. So for me, Valhalla would be on the buffet would have to be pastrami and pickles from Orowitz's Deli. Mm. And then we can maybe flesh out what else would be on that Quad Cities Valhalla feast table
like
at some point.
Yeah, there we go.
Because you are a very interesting person and have done so many interesting things, I always hit people up with the question, what are you consuming nowadays in terms of books, media, things like that, when you have a minute? Because I know you're a pretty busy person.
I try and balance myself out. I feel strongly about supporting our public library. Mm-hmm. So, I always try and check out books as often as I can.
So what you're reading?
I am reading Diana Pasulka, American Cosmic.
American Cosmic.
Yeah.
That sounds interesting.
It is fascinating. She's a religious professor from somewhere. I don't remember. But this book note is about UFOs and the presence of unidentified anomalous phenomena and the impact that it has on religion and culture. Mm-hmm. And I just love the way she writes about it because it's very believable.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never had any experiences per se. I mean, you know, there's databases out there of UFO sightings and, you know, and my grandfather has said he's seen UFOs fly over the farm.
Wow.
Yeah. Back in the, whenever. But so, yeah, that's what I'm reading, American Cosmic by Diana Posilka.
And then they have this Disclosure Day. Right?
Oh, the film. And Steven Spielberg.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I'm debating whether or not to go see that.
Oh, I'm seeing it.
Are you really?
Yeah. I'm all about my film criteria is it's got to have monsters and aliens.
Really?
That's my two things.
That's so fascinating.
Yeah.
Well,
love monsters, love aliens. Yeah.
Then what are you watching lately in terms of whether it's streaming or going to a movie or anything else like that?
Streaming, we've watched some really good sci-fi series. One's called For All Mankind.
I'd heard about
that. Yeah, it's really good. We watched Fallout.
Okay.
It's like a future dystopian.
I can't watch that genre right now because it's like watching the news. So I'm not gonna go there for right now.
Yeah, we just got done with that one, but now we've kind of segued into some action drama series.
Have you happened to see a film called The Death of Stalin?
No.
It's hilarious. And all I can say is there's no way on earth that Steve Buscemi should work as Nikita Khrushchev, but he pulls it off. Okay, so it's worth watching for that alone. But my dear friend and filmmaker and the student Academy Award winner, Rob Humphrey, he said, no, we're going to sit down. We're going to watch Death of Stalin. I'm so glad we did. The challenge to listeners now is if you go out and watch Death of Stalin, then you have to report back to me where you spot the cameo of John Cleese. It lasts less than 2 seconds. And that's your challenge, dear friends. Watch Death of Stalin and report to me what role John Cleese has as a lightning fast cameo in that movie.
And I am a Steve Buscemi fan for sure.
But he's so good. And there's so many. And then the actor whose name I cannot remember, but he was Malfoy's dad. He's a great British actor, but he's in there as Marshal Zhukov. And the whole film, it's worth seeing. But can you believe it, my friend?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know.
That went fast. That went fast.
We've run out of time. How did that happen?
I don't know.
Well, but I can't thank you enough. My guest this week is Holly Sparkman from the Quad Cities Film Office. And please remind me once more the name, the website, so we can go and find more details.
QCAfilmOffice.com.
QCAfilmOffice.com.
Sign up for our newsletter.
And sign up for the newsletter. I know I want to now, but thank you very much for being with us, and always a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you.
And remember, friends, even though that'll do it for this week, you can always catch the conversation twice each week on WVIK. So yeah, Saturday morning, live at 10 o'clock, right before Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. But then there's a rebroadcast Monday evenings at 8, right after Fresh Air. You can also always find episodes at wvik.org. Just look for us under the podcast tab. Well, from the campus of Augustana College, this is Kai Swanson inviting you to join us next week for The Conversation on WVIK. Our guest next week is going to be Brian Ritter from Nahant Marsh. We're looking forward to a great conversation there. In fact, it's going to be a great week here to go out and check places like Nahant Marsh. The weather, we got some rain hither and yon, but it's nice and seasonable. So enjoy your week and hope to see you next week on The Conversation on WVIK. Thanks for tuning in.
You've been listening to The Conversation on WVIK. If you missed part of it or just want to hear it again, tune in at 8 o'clock on Monday evening, right here on WVIK. Support for WVIK comes from the Genesius Guild, offering public performances of classical drama all summer long in Rock Island's Lincoln Park. Shows include Sophocles' Antigone, Shakespeare's The Taming of the Shrew, and Aristophanes' Women's Festival. For more, visit GenesiusGuild.org.
I'm Meadow, and WCIK is my station.
It's the button you can set just for NPR News here in the Iowa-Illinois area. WVIK, 90.3 FM and HD Rock Island, along with 95.9 FM, K240 DZ Dubuque. WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.